VanWee Financial is a registered investment advisor. Information presented is for educational purposes only and does not intend to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies. Investments involve risk and, unless otherwise stated, are not guaranteed. Be sure to first consult with a qualified financial advisor and or tax professional before implementing any strategy discussed herein. It's Saturday morning. It's 10 o'clock. This is the VanWee Financial Hour. I'm Steve VanWee.
And I'm Adam VanWee.
And I'm Scott Snyder.
You might have heard a new and different voice today. We are pleased to have in the studio with us a young man who specializes in funding your kids' educations. And since they're not going to get any cheaper as your young children are growing up, get some questions together and find out how you can get some help doing this. I tell you, a lot of our clients are thinking about this. Many of them for many years have joined the Florida Prepaid and various 529s and so on. Whatever we have done, it's obviously never enough planning in advance because you see the one statistic that just sort of bears that out. $1.5 trillion. That's the college debt that kids own today. And well, I'm going to tell you,
not just kids,
kids and
a
parents.
A lot of that is owned by by adults at this point too, including myself.
And the number one thing you got to remember about that is you can't get rid of that debt except by one way, the old-fashioned way: pay for it.
Yeah, it's not bankruptcy.
So be careful. I guess the corollary here would be very careful what you get into, because you have to work your way out of it. Mm-hmm. And we'll get into that as time goes by. And, of course, we'll do all the usual things in all the usual ways, except for one. That one being, I'm going to introduce the trivia question earlier than normal because it pertains to college funding. So I thought I'd give it out right now, then we'll get into the market wrap and that sort of thing. So the question for this week: what is the average amount parents expect their kids to save before the kid enters college? The average amount to the nearest $1,000. All right, I'm going to say one thing about the market this week. Two things I'm going to say. One was, it had to happen. It's an investment in our long-term trade process. And, of course, it was going to be negative. And the other one would be very simple. Uber is in need of a lift.
That was cheesy.
Could not help myself on that one, sorry.
All right. Yeah, so the last couple of weeks we saw the markets end mixed with one index down and a couple up, and that was not the case this week. It was a pretty broad sell-off, and everything ended up down. But thanks to a late rally on Friday, it wasn't nearly as bad as it could have been. Actually, Thursday and Friday we saw late trading pick up the market, and on Friday, I believe it was something like a 600-point swing. It was pretty. It was down to something.
One day was 450, and I don't remember if that was Friday or not, but
yeah, it was a couple of really big swings to the positive. So that has me at least optimistic going into next week. It was all sparked by one thing, that was the China trade worries. And on Sunday night, President Trump took to Twitter, as he is so apt to do, and told the world that China was backing down on all the promises they had made on the trade negotiations, and therefore he was going to raise tariffs to the original proposal of 25% on Friday. Well, as you can imagine, futures didn't like that, and they plummeted immediately, and the market pretty much stayed negative all week until Friday. The net effect of this was that the markets dropped between 2 and 3% during the week, and the trade deal is still being negotiated. Our stance has not changed on this. We think the deal will get done. We want it. China needs it. And it's big and complicated and messy. And the biggest thing is that we have to figure out a way for China to stop stealing our intellectual property without admitting that they ever stole our intellectual property. Because they don't want to admit that, but we need it to go away. So once we figure out how to do that, I think the deal gets done. I'm not even going to guess as to a timeline, though. So for the week, technology, industrials, and materials took the brunt of the losses, while consumer staples, energy, and utilities held up the best. There wasn't a clear winner in market cap, as this decline hit pretty much everything from small cap to large caps. Usually when the turmoil is about international trade, small caps fare better than large caps, but that was not the case this week. But the U.S. market was not the only one that saw declines. China was even deeper in the red, losing almost 7.5%. European indexes dropped 2 to 3%, while India and Hong Kong saw losses greater than 5%. So kind of declines across the board. But it looks like we have a call.
Good morning, Chuck.
Hey, good morning, guys.
What's happening?
You know, for the life of me, I can't figure out why Trump is so blind to these tariffs. You know, I'll give you an example. If you go to Walmart and you buy a $150 bicycle that's made in China, and then the tariffs go up to 25%, and then you end up paying $170 for the bike that cost $150 last month, who is paying the tariff? The American consumer is paying it, not the Chinese.
Sure. Let me ask you, I'll answer a question by asking you a question. What is Trump's goal for tariffs?
I think he wants to try and level the playing field ultimately, but I don't think that's going to happen.
What is he? Well, now let's not jump to a conclusion yet. What is the ultimate amount of a tariff that he's striving to put on everything that comes into this country?
Zero.
Bingo. You just answered the question. The ultimate tariff system is zero out, zero in. How do you get somebody to play ball with that? By charging them nothing to bring things in while they charge you 25%? There's no incentive built into that system. Trump understands one thing better than anybody in D.C., apparently, and that is the simple fact that these people are not going to go away with helping us at all, or at least extricating our problem, without force. He understands completely that it's only going to be a show of force that does it. We have been losing $500 billion on a one-way ticket just to China for years and years and years. You know what China does with that money? They come back here and they buy our assets. Smithfield food, real estate. They buy all kinds of good things. They're hoarding gold like there's no tomorrow. These are all being done with American dollars that are there because they charge tariffs on what we send, which also is crushing our exporters. This is short-term pain in the name of long-term success. And there's no other way out of it. We tried doing nothing for the last four presidents or so, and we're in the exact same place that we were four presidents ago. So I applaud his efforts, and I, for one, firmly believe that it's going to work.
Hope you're right.
Yeah, everybody hopes I'm right, especially me. Now, I understand your point of view completely, but I think this is a we're taking one for the team right now, so to speak. We got to do it because China's not going to back off. And, of course, that's going to, if this happens before the vote on the new NAFTA, the USMTA, or USMTC, whatever the name is called, the Canada and Mexico-USA trade agreement, if they can get the Chinese deal settled, the European deal will settle, and the North American deal will settle. And when all that happens, then tariffs start to head toward their zero mark, and we're the winner. Will it? All I can tell you is stay tuned and hopefully keep the faith for a while. And I hear you. I understand. I don't like paying the extra money either. Nobody does. You'd be foolish to do so. So you keep in touch. Want to take a quick shot at the trivia, Chuck? Got a few seconds.
What is the question?
How much does the average parent expect their child to save before the child enters college?
In thousands.
No, it's more than that. You'd be surprised because parents actually have expectations. Huh. All right, got to run. The stuff is playing here. We'll be right back. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And I'm Scott Snyder.
We are going to wrap up quickly a few more things about the market, and then we're going to get into talking about educational funding, something that's near and dear to many of us, whether or not you have kids and or grandkids that are going into college. Sometimes it matters because you're already in debt. All right. Tell me a little bit about the yield curve and why it's unimportant.
Well, I don't agree with that necessarily.
what happened to the yield curve this week?
The yield curve inverted again this week. So what that's saying, it's too complicated to go into detail, but basically what that's saying is that short-term bonds are paying more than longer-term bonds. And that's just not right. The longer term your bonds, the more risk you're taking, so the more you should be compensated for that. So when this happens, it's sometimes a predictor of a recession. And so you're going to see a lot of talk about that. It's not an immediate predictor, but it can be a 3 to 5 year, 1 to 5 year predictor.
Precursor?
So, yeah, it's something to keep an eye on. I don't want to say that we're headed into recession, because I don't believe that right now. But in some ways, we always are headed into recession, because the next one will come. You just don't know when. So that's all. I mean, just something to keep an eye on.
Okay, I got a couple more afterthoughts. One of the great companies of all time that you'd want to triple play, that's a beat on the revenue, a beat on the
earnings,
and
sales,
also an increase of guidance.
Right.
That company, one of those companies this particular quarter was Apple.
Oh.
I think that's a tremendous bullish sign. But there's another bullish sign, too. You familiar with the Manitowoc Company?
Only from vaguely.
Yeah, the Manitowoc Company goes way, way back in my wife's family. Her dad used to work with them as a consultant for many, many years. And the family had quite a bit of stock that they accumulated during that time because they liked what they saw. Well, the Manitowoc Company is absolutely booming. They make cranes. What are cranes used for?
Buildings.
What's the lead time on cranes?
Long.
So people are ordering cranes. That tells me a lot.
Yeah.
That's a different version of the caterpillar effect.
Having recently been on the West Coast in the Bay Area, those cranes are everywhere.
All right. The second thing, the yield curve is not often considered against a certain backdrop. Well, one of those backdrops is tariffs. Has there been a lot of inflation since the tariffs were imposed?
No.
No, in fact, actually, it's slowed down overall. I'm not talking about a specific good. But that leads me to wonder why. And one of the things that I thought about this morning, real early this morning, the dollar has been so strong that it's harder for our exporters, but it's cheaper for importers. And you know who set that up? China.
Well, it would make sense.
China manipulated their currency the second Trump put those first tariffs on, so that we're paying about the same for the Chinese things. Now, this is not the new 25% tariffs. This is the old 10% tariffs.
Right, the original.
What do you want to bet with me that China's going to change their currency value again?
It's very possible.
They said they'd retaliate.
Yeah.
I wouldn't bet.
I wouldn't bet against me. Just keep that in mind if you hear this coming week or so, that one of the things China's doing is manipulating their currency yet again. If we got to get to a point eventually where the yuan is allowed to float against all the other currencies, you don't have a free market unless your currency is involved in it. All right, that said, let's jump on to our number one topic of the week, which is, as I said, educational funding. I think I'm just going to start by asking Scott to give us a little background on him, qualifications, what he does, where he does it, how he does it, how he charges for it, and why you might actually need some help.
So I specialize in really all areas of college. One is the upfront side with parents, helping them plan for the front end of helping them figure out what they need to do to get their kid into college in an affordable manner.
Well, you just need a couple million bucks in the right pocket, right?
Exactly.
I suggest inheritance.
Yeah, that too. Unfortunately, most parents are struggling with it, and especially Gen X people, it's their number one worry ahead of retirement. So it's a big pain point for a lot of people.
Largely, I think, because that's the really most educated group of people that this country's ever seen. What do you expect if you're educated? You expect your kids to get educated.
Absolutely.
Yeah, every generation wants the next one to be a little bit better off, so that makes sense.
But people who don't get in front of me on the front end, I also help them what I call the rescue mode with student loans. So that was how I found my company 2 years ago, was around really focusing on the young professional who's struggling to get out from under their student loan debt, because it's really crushing them in many different ways. They're delaying marriage, they're delaying having kids, delaying buying a house. So it's really slowing down our economy from that perspective, and really we could be growing things a lot more if they weren't burdened with so much debt. So at the end of the day, I provide two kind of college-focused services, and also tie that into a more of a comprehensive plan, because you really can't just prioritize paying down the debt or just saving for college. It has to make sense within the overall plan. So I charge a kind of one-time service fee for the student loan part, and then sometimes that's if they want more comprehensive advice, I tie that to just an upfront fee of $500 for the student loan plan, and then an ongoing fee of $175 if they want me to provide more comprehensive services.
Okay. What's the bulk of your business? Is it people who are already in debt or people planning for future?
Already in debt, because that's how I started things off. Okay. But there's been a shift in focus towards the college funding side and looking at it a little bit more creatively. Think of like getting a mortgage. You get pre-approved for it. Not with college. They basically, the universities and colleges out there give you money.
That's basically
freely.
Part of the problem.
I mean, it's a huge part of the problem. That's what's you're really causing the cost of college to go up 5-6% per year. And we can't keep that pace. Something needs to change.
And I believe that's down from a few years ago when it was going up 10-12%.
Yeah. It's amazing how much the cost of college, you know, back in your day, you were able to probably go, you know, get a summer job and pay your tuition. Not anymore.
$125 a semester.
Yeah. Nowadays, you're lucky to pay one semester from your summer job. And that's just the tuition, not the room and board or anything like that.
It's scary, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
And what can you do if you're, well, let's start with the ones that can do something. If you're a young professional making good money, knowing you got to get out of debt, what does the average person you see have for debt size, and what can they do to get rid of it?
It really depends on the profession. The grad school level types where, you know, you've got a physician or a dentist are the worst. They come out with almost, I mean, I've seen $300,000 to $400,000 in student debt.
I read about a dentist out west that had $1 million+.
Yeah. I actually have a client who she's a physician here in town, and she has over $500,000.
Wow.
Yeah. And she makes really good income, but you know, it's at the end of the day, it's prevented her from doing a lot of things that she wanted to do in her life. And so that's why I provide that service. Is I saw one of my good friends who is a veterinarian. They're probably the worst in terms of income to debt ratio, because mm-hmm. they're making $80,000-$90,000 coming out, $100,000 if they're lucky to find the right opportunity. But their debt load is well over $200,000 on average.
Wow.
Yeah. So, but back to my point about my client is, and he's also happened to be a good friend, it was his fiance where I saw $160,000 in debt, and it grew to $190,000 because of the interest accrues even while you're getting your education, which
seems wrong to me. Don't you love the term negative amortization?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
If I could get a 6.8% guaranteed return, I think a lot of people out there would buy that.
I think I'd be in right away. Mm-hmm. It's funny.
And another point here is the federal government's largest asset is student loans by a wide margin. We're talking 45% of their balance sheet.
Wow.
Did it get better or worse when the government took over the student loan business?
I think it's always been bad. Quite frankly, probably a little worse because it's more convoluted and it's very nuanced. So borrowers out there that they really have a 1 in 8 chance to get it right because there's 8 different programs that they can choose from.
Wow. In terms of your options to repay?
Yeah. Yep.
Well, let's talk about those a little bit. What are your – let's say you have accrued student loans and you are faced with the decision. What are your options and how do you decide what option is best for you?
So that's a good question. It's pretty detailed. There's what I call a borrowing hierarchy, where there's different programs on the front end that you can get loans from. So there's direct subsidized, direct unsubsidized, grad plus, private lending, fixed rates, parent plus, and private lenders, variable rates. That's the order.
Yeah.
I would go in from borrowing.
Let's say you have the standard subsidized and unsubsidized and maybe a small private loan. What are your repayment options?
So you can – with the private loan, you absolutely have to pay almost like a standard repayment on an amortization 10 years, 20 years.
Whatever they gave you terms up front.
Right. Okay. So there's no flexible, and we'll continue this here in a bit, but really there's, as I said, 8 programs out there, and some of the best ones are income related, where you can lower your payment.
Yeah.
Because on a 10-year amortization, you're talking, you know, on a $100,000 loan, $1,000 a month.
Okay.
And that's, you know, if you're just getting out of college, that's like a mortgage payment.
Yeah, for sure.
It was one or the other, it's that or the mortgage, right?
Yep.
After the break, I got a couple more things. And one of them, I know one of the great misconceptions, or at least one of the hopes and dreams of some of the young people today, is debt forgiveness.
Yep.
Now, there's the way it is, there's the way it's proposed, and then there's the things they don't tell you.
Absolutely.
We'll get into that right after the break. All right, we've got to pay some bills. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
I'm Adam Van Wee.
And I'm Scott Snyder.
And we are talking today about the primary subject, educational funding, planning for funding, paying it off, and so on. Scott is a resident specialist in this area, and by gosh, I know that we need them, because every once in a while, in the course of our day jobs, we get asked, who's good at this college funding thing? And frankly, I had only ever heard of one person prior to Adam meeting you that did this professionally, and it was a company devoted just to that. I talked to a couple of people that have talked to her and said she's very good, but she's really pricey.
Right.
But and you got to pay for quality.
And the other, absolutely, I'm of the belief that when you pay a premium for something, that you usually get what you paid for. When you try to go cheap, you often are just left disappointed.
I'm also a big believer in having some qualifications, and you have those three initials after your name that we think are the most important three in any aspect of this business, those being CFP.
Yeah.
So we're in the presence of a lot of CFPs in this room today, and that's, quite frankly, that's my major consideration in bringing you on the show, was that you have bothered to qualify yourself as an expert in many things with a concentration on one being a CFP. So good for you, I say. We need more of them.
Thank you.
All right, we're kind of taking this from the back end over. I said after the break I wanted to talk about I wanted to repeat the trivia question because there's an add-on to it. How much money does the average parent expect their kid to save up prior to going to college? We know it's greater than zero, but I'm going to tell you something else. Very few parents actually bother to discuss that with their children.
Mm-hmm. I'm not surprised.
No shock there.
No.
So you have these great expectations for your kids. You don't tell them. And comes then, time to go to college.
No wonder they're always a disappointment.
Duh. Yeah. You set them up for failure, why don't you?
Quite frankly, money's not discussed enough with parents and their kids.
True.
In general.
And
not
the
just
education's
college.
Just not out there. It should be in the school system.
Yeah, it should be.
Yeah, we firmly believe that as well.
Yeah, I've been railing about that for a lot of years. Anyway, I want to start kind of at the tail end, or people reaching the tail end, because I think there's so many false impressions out there that can really come back and haunt you. I want you to talk a bit about forgiveness.
Yeah, that's a big one.
I'll take out all this money because all I got to do is work for a while, and then it's going to go away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, there's a lot of misperceptions on how to qualify. A lot of people just assume, and then they don't understand how nuanced it really is. There's two types of forgiveness out there. You really, obviously, under a standard plan, you're just going to pay it to zero. So, but the other plans out there that are income-based, it's all tied to income at a rate of 10 to 15%. And the ones that are out there.
On your gross or your take home?
It's actually on your discretionary income. So they use the poverty level tables with factoring in family size.
Okay.
So that gets subtracted off of your gross.
Right.
And any contributions you make to a retirement plan. And that's what essentially they're using to calculate.
Available funds, in other words.
Yeah. So it's at 10 to 15%, and you have the pay as you earn plan, the revised pay as you earn plan, which is a revision to the other option, the pay plan, and I'm going to use some acronyms sometimes, but the pay is pay as you earn, repay is revised pay as you earn, and then you have the old income-based repayment and the new income-based repayment. There's several of those that, and then the income contingent repayment. Of those, you should be eliminating, like, basically the income, new IBR, and the ICR.
And why? What are they and why?
They're irrelevant, in my opinion, because there's the three that really need to be considered are the pay as you earn and the revised pay as you earn and old IBR. And the reason for that is those have better terms, very nuanced terms that probably would take me the next half hour to go into.
Yeah, we don't want to be too specific.
Yeah, but you're talking the best program out there, if you can qualify, is the pay as you earn program because it's 10% of income. And you can file your income taxes separately so that it can just be based on one of the borrower's income. And so it allows you to lower your payments so that you can basically take advantage of the public service loan forgiveness, which you really want to minimize what you're paying because your loans get forgiven in 10 years. But the only way to qualify is you have to have an income-based repayment plan. You have to be in the public sector, so a nonprofit 501c3 or a university or government job. So
hospitals?
Yeah, hospitals qualify as long as they're a nonprofit. There are some hospitals that aren't.
Okay, right.
Yeah.
Like a public defender DA type job.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, so the reason why it's ahead of the revised program, which came under Obama's administration, is the revised pay as you earn doesn't allow you to separate your tax returns. So if you file separately, you're costing yourself a lot of money because they're just going to take both income automatically, both incomes in the household. So it's the pay as you earn program is truly the best if you want to minimize payments. But the revised program has some better interest accrual terms where you're not accruing as much interest along the way. So it's just if you're going to a single person, you might go with the revised pay as you earn.
All right. The most common lack of knowledge that I see in things like this is that people don't understand that debt forgiven equals income.
Yeah, well, so the public service loan forgiveness, the reason why that's such an attractive program is that at the back end, all that debt is forgiven, whatever's remaining.
That's not a W-2 item then.
No, it's tax-free.
Oh, so. Wow.
Yeah, and I didn't know any of that existed. I had heard that there were some ways to do that.
Yeah, so I mean, with some of my clients where I've ran projections, we're over $100,000 in savings using that. So we often evaluate an offer with a private company and looking at their projected income and really look at the total value versus what the public service loan forgiveness is offering.
These are things you should know going in.
Yeah, absolutely. Most people don't look that deeply into it, and that's why I often see people in the wrong program. And it's just there's so much nuance to it that you really don't have a good chance of being successful. I mean, maximizing it. You can still be successful along the way, but it's the likelihood of being one out of eight times is what you're dealing with because of all the loan repayment plans
and
that are out there.
Once you've selected, there's no going back. Is that correct?
Well, you can switch between plans, but there's another thing that people need to be aware of. There's a couple other federal loan programs, graduated and extended. Those should be obsolete, really, in my opinion, because there's a lot of borrowers who thought they were in those programs that they were getting their debt forgiven. Those don't qualify for debt forgiveness at all. Not even on the private sector, which is taxable, back to your original question. Mm-hmm. And that tax hit you need to plan for.
Yeah, for sure.
Too many people. I have one of my best friends who's an occupational therapist. He didn't know, and then he came to me to offer some advice around it, and we set up a brokerage account for him to save towards that, so that you almost have to treat that as part of your payment.
Let's talk a little bit more about that because I'm not sure everyone knows what you're talking about, but. All right, let's say you have a $200,000 loan and you were able to pay during the repayment period $100,000 and then they forgive $100,000. What happens?
So that $100,000 is included in your taxable income that year. So you are very likely to bump yourself into a higher bracket and you're paying upwards of say $30,000 to $40,000 depending on your income level and where you live, like places like California.
And that money, that tax money, was spent over the 10 years plus the educational period before that, you don't have any extra cash.
Exactly. Unless you plan ahead. Exactly. Yeah.
So you're telling me that $100,000 of forgiven debt could turn into a $33,000 tax bill?
Yes.
Okay. Easily.
Yeah.
Ouch.
So you can go borrow that, but
then you're back going just back to the same place you were.
With a lower payment.
Well, talk to a loan officer sometime and say, I need $35,000, $40,000. Why? Because I've got this income, phantom income that's coming in because I have my debt repayment on my loan, and you have no money and you have no fundamental
and you might have credit.
Credit
card debt that's already built up. Because
and by the way,
yeah.
I'll guarantee you weren't making a lot of money for those 10 years because you're in the public sector.
Right.
So it sounds,
well, no, that's that, in the public sector, it's forgiven.
Oh,
it's
that's
the private sector.
Debt,
that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, if you get it that way, right?
Well, if you do the public sector program, you don't owe that on your taxes.
Okay,
but
so
in the private
fundamental
one,
fundamental problem,
it's
if
so
we
confusing.
Go backwards, yes,
yeah.
is you better pick an occupation that, if it's going to be expensive to get into, pays well at the end.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
definitely.
We'll get into that a little bit more after this break, too. But you can see now, I'm going to ask you the big question before this is over. When do you start planning for these things? And then, of course, corollary A is, oh, I'm past that now, so what do I do?
Right.
And that's fundamentally where you started your business, apparently.
Yep.
All right, we'll get into that right after the break. Trivia question is still out there. How much do parents expect their kids to save for college before they go? But they don't tell them about it. So maybe we can get people to talk to each other a little bit more. That'll help. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And I'm Scott Snyder.
And we have this segment sponsored by Robinson Landscape and Maintenance. I just ran into him. He's actually making my lawn look pretty this morning. Call Troy at 662-9794. Trivia question still out there. How much does the average parent expect their college-bound child to save prior to going to college, but never really bothers to tell the child about it? You're going to love this one, folks. You're just going to love it. All right, back to the repayment question. Why do we care so much? We were talking in the break, and I mentioned it already once on the show. There's $1.5 trillion out there in student loans, and Scott just told us that 2 years ago it was $1.3, so we can extrapolate from that that it has been growing at the rate of about $100 billion a year. That is apparently slowing down somewhat, and I'd like to think that's because people are getting jobs and able to pay, so that a lot of the defaults and so on are being repaid. And I'd also like to think that somewhere along the line, people are getting a little bit smarter about the possibilities of going into women's studies with a $250,000 loan from Wellesley or something like that is maybe not being the best idea in the world. And then when we get through the rest of it, we're going to talk about free stuff. We're laughing. All right, carry on. We have been doing the different forms of debt forgiveness.
Yeah, so highlighting the one that really is the best bang for your buck because of the tax forgiveness isn't taxed, but is the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, which, again, there's five steps you have to take in order to qualify. You have to be a full-time employee at a nonprofit organization or a government-related job. So hospitals and universities, things like that, state defender, that type of thing. The type of loan needs to be direct. It can't be a FFELP loan, which are some of the older loans out there. That's why when last year only 1% of the applicants who applied for public service loan forgiveness actually got their loans forgiven and canceled.
That's why you hear that stat all the time.
Yeah.
The 1%?
Only 1%.
That's scary.
Yeah, a lot of that's due to the borrowers having no clue. And it's more that than it is actually people getting ripped off by the government. It's not for the reasons that the media and press likes to portray.
Ignorance of the law is no excuse.
Right, exactly. So that's step two. The other the third point is it needs to be in repayment status. So if it's in deferment or
default,
any of the others that are out there, forbearance, you might be thinking, okay, I can make some payments here and there along the way. Those payments don't qualify. So it needs to be in repayment status. And then the repayments need to be used. The fourth point is repayments using an income-driven repayment plan. So that's income-based repayment, pay-as-you-earn, and revised pay-as-you-earn. And then the last point, the fifth one, is 120 on-time payments. And then you have to prove it. You have to certify it through a form and send it into the government.
So during your tenure as a public employee, you better be right up front and on time.
Yep. Yeah. you can leave the public sector and, like, maybe you've earned seven, you know, years worth.
Okay.
And you go, you know, you want to take some time with the kids, whatever it may be, and then you come back into the workforce.
Or make some actual money or something.
Yeah, and you can basically go back into the public sector and still take care of those last 3 years.
Okay.
That's reasonable.
It seems like a good plan. You just have to, you should know about it going into that plan, that that's what you're going to do and follow all the steps. And
yeah, I mean, but there's some pitfalls, too, that people that are listening should avoid. Forgetting to certify their income, because if they do, it goes up back up to the standard repayment, which could be $1,000 plus.
How is that done?
They have to send in a certification form or do it online through the government website.
Okay.
Lumping payments together. So let's say you want to make 5 payments ahead. That still only counts as 1 payment.
Ooh.
So just don't do it.
Nasty.
Yeah. So you really need to, you should pay the minimum, because that's ironically the best way to save on what you're actually getting from the program. You definitely don't want to be in the graduated or extended plans, because those don't count. And failing to consolidate federal loan, the FFEL loan, so it's, I call it the FEL program, the older loans that were out there, if you fail to consolidate those, the FEL loans don't count towards the public service loan forgiveness. Yeah.
Right. So, what's the difference between refinancing and consolidating?
Good question.
Because so, they both wind up in a refinance situation, right?
Sort of. That's the misconception out there. Really, it's a consolidation is you have to be very careful about it. Because if you consolidate, let's say you're doing the private sector forgiveness, which I haven't gotten into yet, you lose all those payments. And you have to start back from square one. So it's really just consolidating. You have about I've seen people have upwards of 20 loans because it's throughout their time in school. It's organizing that all under one loan. I'm imagining basically managing 12 mortgages.
So you hear commercials all the time for debt consolidation. It seems like what normal people would do, right?
Exactly. So it's there's because of how it's defined in a traditional sense, there's a misconception about it when it comes to student loans. But refinancing is how you would think of refinancing. You're trying to lower your interest rate. And I think the other mistake I see a lot is people going out there and refinancing too early. The federal programs out there provide a lot more benefits if you lose your job, things like that.
Ah.
So the forbearance factor, the status that I was telling you about, there's more forgiveness around that, or you can really stretch that out more than you can with a private lender.
You know what I'm listening to here?
What's that?
I'm listening to a good case for doing a lot of advanced planning for college.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about that. What if we've talked a lot about what happens if you're already in this situation, but how would you, if someone came to you and said, I want to save for my kids' college, what would you tell them?
Really, it depends on what stage they are. If they're in the, you know, get them at the early stages, they just had their child. Obviously, a 529 plan is probably the best bang for your buck out there because of the tax-free or tax-deferred growth, and then the tax-free if used for college, it's all the growth can be tax-free, pulled out.
One of only about 4 sources of tax-free money that I know of that are available in this world.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some of which legal, within your lifetime.
Legal tax-free.
Yeah. Some of which during your lifetime will go away.
You don't know that.
I bet you.
At the later stages, say 8th grade, freshman year, good time to really get on the front, basically prepared for paying for college. And too many parents kind of go about it the wrong way. They look for they look at the schools and they get their kid falls in love with one, but they don't know if they can afford it. And that's what a service that I provide, what I call college pre-approval. Similar to how you go get qualified for a mortgage. Like, sure, I want the house that LeBron James has, but I can't pay multi-million for a multi-million-dollar house. I get turned down right away. Well, it's the same process with the service that I provide, and really it's helping them look at what they can budget for and what resources they currently have available to them, and providing some creative tax advice, especially if they're business owners, and using things like the kiddie tax out there if they're using what's known as an UGMA account. That's another account that it's owned by the miner, and they can sell any stocks or securities at a gain and not incur any taxes because of the kiddie tax rule. So you just kind of gradually unwind it before they get to college. So there's a lot of nuance even to that where we can help stretch the dollars and make sure they're not paying more than what they're going to borrow.
Should people fill out their own FAFSA forms without talking to somebody first?
Yeah, a lot of times. And there's a lot of confusion with FAFSA. A lot of people don't even bother with it.
That's what I was reading recently, that not everybody even knows enough to fill out a FAFSA form.
Yeah, they really need an advisor out there that can help with that and make sure that they're leaving no stone unturned when it comes to what the colleges are going to provide for your student.
Okay, well, time's getting short here, and I wanted to replay something that we talked about in the break, which of course has slipped my mind because I'm over 65. But the other thing I wanted to make sure we got in was Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, all that. They're telling us that it's going to be free.
Yeah, right.
You want to say a couple words about that?
I don't see that happening. I think the taxpayer would have a big problem with that being passed down to them. And
the guy sitting to your right would have a big problem with that.
So I'm almost done paying off my loan. Now I got to pay off all of your loans? I don't think so.
People fail to forget, having to pay for it. It allows for people to get access to higher education, especially at the grad school level, that they might not be able to otherwise pay for.
For sure.
And that helps increase the tax base.
Well, one thing I've noted for sure, that is there's going to be a part two to this. Because we didn't get very deep into it. We knew that hours go by very quickly here. Really enjoyed having you here. If you want to get in touch with Scott, call our office or email us or something. We'll get you through all that, and you will be hearing him again. The average parent expects their kid to save up $10,000 toward college.
I guess.
Which would be a lot easier if the kid knew what that expectation were, but it doesn't happen that way. Talk to your kids about money. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour.